welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are praying for Trezeguet in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it's been a great week on Planet Albion. Last Saturday, we left Villa Park with all 3 points in our pocket for the first time ever, and then, and perhaps most importantly, the government announced that from the 3rd of December, clubs up and down the country will be able to start repopulating their stadiums. We now know that Brighton will be in Tier 2, which means that the club will be able to admit 2,000 people into the Amex for next weekend's game against Southampton, which has now been moved to the Monday. This also means that with a fair wind, this weekend's game against Liverpool will be the last behind closed doors at the Amex. Possibly. Joining me today, as we take all of this in, is, of course, Alan Wares. And Andy Bass is with us as well. Oh, and we also have a competition for you where you can win an Art of Football T-shirt or print. Breathe. Hello, chaps. It's been a great week.
Didn't your beer taste so much nicer this week, last weekend, Andy?
Oh, very, very much so. It was a really good match. It was a really good match last week. And an excellent result, and I thought a deserved result as well. A different sort of performance from the Albion last week showed that, you know, we can win in a slightly, I wouldn't say gritty fashion, but I thought we had to contend with different problems from Villa than we have in other games. I thought we dealt with everything very, very well, apart from the Villa goal,
we'll come to that in a minute. I mean, it was a bit of a bizarre one for me as well. I mean, I was watching, I had an empty house, the girls were out, and so the level of Tourette's induced behaviour come the end of that game, which we'll talk about very shortly.
I don't think it's Tourette's, mate. I think, you know, you don't actually have that particular psychotic episode about you. I think that, you know, it's just the fact that you are a one-man walking square box.
There is a possibility that may have happened.
I mean sitting, leaping, shouting, jumping, doing the quote of the settee.
Okay, well let's look back over that game last weekend then. And there was two changes to the side that drew a blank against Burnley, with Captain Lewis Dunk returning, and also Solly March was fit again. Veltman and Byrne dropped to the bench, and it was 100th appearance for Pascal Gross. So let's talk about Pascal. He's been kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say he's been a forgotten player, but he's not held in the same sort of esteem as he was in after his first season.
When you realise, when we had our first season in the Premier League, he was the one who seemed to take to it quite a lot quicker and a lot easier than others did. Scored the first goal, got the first assists, and he got the figures, he got the stats together, and he got Player of the Season. Whether that was deserved or not, I'm not saying it was undeserved, but, you know, I had sort of more favourite players. And that's the thing about Gross, is that the thing that I think more than anything that anyone could ever say about him is he's slow, immobile maybe, statuesque possibly, likes to imitate an elm tree whilst on the football pitch. But having said that, he does keep the game ticking over. He's not the same as Davy Proper in as much as Proper can move about. But when you see Potter's style of having to be fast and effective and fluid, you still see Gross taking that extra touch, and yet somehow it's still okay. I can see that there is an upgrade on Gross that could happen within the club, but for the time being, he is ticking things over nicely, and actually the game against Villa is his perfect sort of game.
Yeah, Andy, 100 games for Pascal?
Yeah, I didn't realise he'd actually amassed that many. He still feels like a relatively sort of a new signing and a forgotten man at the same time, rather bizarrely. but he had a sneakily very good game on Saturday. And, you know, I have to say, I would be one of those people in the stands saying, oh, he's a bit too slow, why don't we get, you know, so-and-so in instead, and yada yada. And I'll have to hold my hands up and I'll say I thought Pascal reminded me of why, you know, of A, why we held him in such high esteem previously, and B, why Potter has decided to pick him. It's just basically the quality of the passing is so good.
But he's now started the last three games as well, Andy. And I mean, and under Potter Ball, I mean, it's generally been about fast transitions, which isn't necessarily something you would associate with Gross, but he's certainly becoming instrumental to that.
But also part of that is not running about. Part of it is actually just playing, is making sure that the ball you play is accurate to the next person. So it's the transfer of possession from one player to the other, which is like stating the bleeding obvious. But
yeah, well, we could have that. But
that's what Pascal Gross does. He doesn't really hang about with the ball. He kind of hangs about on the pitch, or certainly appears to. But without sort of doing anything flashy, things just seem to happen as a result of the linking up that he does, of his vision. And that is something that is difficult to, you know, be good at.
Yeah.
Having that vision on the pitch.
Now, Al, I mean, one of Pascal's trademarks is he has the ability to find space where there is no space.
I do that when I've had a curry as well. It's a good way of doing that in different circumstances. I mean, it was him that put the ball across the area for Solly March to score, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It was his cross. I mean, that I think actually epitomises the bloke more than anything. He can do his slow motion Cruyff turn, and he had a go at it. It didn't really come off, but you could see that the goal. And we'll analyse it a lot better in detail. But that pass to Solly, it looks like he scuffed it, but it's not. It's an absolutely inch perfect pass. And you can see just how bad the pitch at Villa Park is anyway, where you see the ball trundling along, and it's with each roll, it's gaining more and more height. But that the way he picked that pass out, I think, justifies his inclusion in its own right. Yes, he can find space. I think he's helped by the fact of Bissouma and Lallana, who themselves are expert space finders. Bissouma will receive the ball. He'll have three players around him, nudge it over there, and lo and behold, he's sorted himself out 3 yards. Pass it to Gross, who find himself on his own, and they make it in that sense look majestic. I think that you need, for Pascal Gross to look as good as he is at the moment, you do need the likes of Lallana and Bissouma. Possibly because I see them as an upgrade on what's gone before. So yeah, it's everyone is improving, and the irritation that we've had over the past few weeks is we played well, not getting results for it. But when you see that the ball that does go, we could discuss any given game of Gross creating a chance, of Bissouma creating a chance, of even Trossard creating a chance, but because they don't go in, we don't talk about it necessarily. But when they do, that's when we say, hey, it sounds great. The number of times that Gross will put a cross in, and there's no one there. But then you can say about the same about Trossard or even Welbeck's doing that now. Once you see them put that pass in and there's no one there to tuck it home, it doesn't look like such a good move. But when it does go in, it looks amazing.
Okay. Well, let's move on from Pascal then. And the post-match headlines were pretty much, we won for a start, but there was a lot of talk about the penalty at the end. But there wasn't any talk at all about the penalty that we should have had, which happened very early on, Andy, where Lamptey got upended in the box by Grealish.
Yes, funnily enough, it was the same move that Grealish tried when he got Lamptey sent off at the end, which is basically shoving himself in front of Lamptey's body. This time it was, to prevent Lamptey. And it was barely looked at and just passed over as one of those things, because Lamptey's quite a little guy. But he actually doesn't go down easily. He's a bit of a hard nut. And, we can't not talk about the referee and decisions in this game, because ultimately they were pivotal at the end. Mm. But I think there are so many other positive aspects of the football to talk about. I think we can gloss over this one and say, it's just one of those ones we didn't get, move on. basically.
But it's, the thing is, Andy, it's happening quite often, isn't it? We, you know, when we get back to the Man United game, Connolly, you know, instigated the foul and therefore not a foul. And you think, how many times has Jack Grealish done this? I mean, sorry, AD, I'm going to sort of like, you know, bend your agenda here, but we've got to talk about the notion that Jack Grealish is clever, like Harry Kane, that he is clever at getting fouls. Andy, he's really not, is he?
People buy it because he's a good, because he, again, like, you know, like Harry Kane, he's a good footballer. He has a lot to admire about his game.
And he doesn't need that part, does he?
But it's part of what he does. I mean, you know, I mean, I imagine how good he'd be if he actually stayed on his feet for more than 5 minutes in a game. And it's pathetic, and it's just incredible that week in, week out, these players keep getting away with it. And sort of fast forwarding, but you know, he cheated to get Lamptey sent off.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that,
and had to cheat to mouth off at him.
To talk about that in a minute, Andy. But first, I mean, with the going into the game, there's a lot of talk about Grealish being one of the Villa danger men. One of their, possibly their signing of the summer was actually bringing in Ross Barkley as well, who's really, really shone in that Villa side. Do you think it was instrumental that they lost him that early, that we performed so well?
Not necessarily. I don't think so. Sorry, Andy, go on, you take it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know that he has played well for them, and certainly, I thought we handled their midfield pretty well. So who knows? He could have made a difference. Certainly, you know, Grealish will sometimes need someone to take a little bit of the load off for him, and Barkley certainly does that.
I think that's what I was saying there, Andy. Because I mean, last season, if Grealish wasn't performing well, Villa really struggled. But this season, they've got Barkley and Grealish, and who are carrying the workload for them. They're not so much of the one-man team which they were previously. So it kind of put more pressure on Grealish to a certain degree too.
Watching that game, AD, I wouldn't say that Grealish was the only person creating stuff. I mean, I thought that actually Aston Villa were actually very impressive going forward. I mean, for me, they're a bit like the O.J. Simpson trial. They're all faced, they're all up front, but they've got no defence. They are, let's say, really exciting. And let's face it, but for Trezeguet, who made Maupay look like Pele, it would have, you know, it could have been pretty horrific, because you know that Villa don't have a particularly good defence, and yet, you know, there were times, you know, we looked, obviously looked very good, but for a little bit more cunning, a little bit more guile, I think we could have actually taken that defence to shreds, because it's rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, again, the finishing was off. But I do have to ask you a question at this point.
Go on, then.
What would you say is our favourite word to use on this show?
No, it wasn't with aplomb. It was a lovely dink.
Was it a chip or a dink? And in commentary, I used clip. But I'm saying aplomb. He had a lot of time on his head. I mean, obviously, here we're talking about Danny Welbeck's first goal for the Albion. And, I mean, when was the last time we scored a breakaway goal like that? I mean, I was
to score a hell of a lot of them under when we had Anthony Knockaert in the Championship. Mm-hmm. And you'd have had Zamora in the days when he could run, and Hemed and what have you. And everyone would do their best to try and keep up with Anthony Knockaert, and then we'd still smash the goals home. But a goal like that, which, let's face it, after we saw it on Match, when I saw it at the time, I'm thinking, this is pathetic defending. But then when you see Shearer and Wrighty take it apart on Match of the Day, it's absolutely abysmal defending. I mean, Welbeck is 5 yards ahead of the defenders, who decided to be 15 yards inside our half. I mean, they're saying, clearly wasn't offside. It's because he was in his own half. You know, even VAR would have struggled not to have got that anyway. So, yeah, he ran.
I'm sure they would have tried, Al.
I'm sure. But what impressed me most of all, I mean, we're all of the opinion here that Danny Welbeck is this sort of like ageing, knackered old sick note. And once upon a time, he might have been. Incidentally, he turns 30 today. Happy birthday. But he is this aging, knackered old sick note. But he, you could hear that, you know, you could hear the legs powering away. But once he knew that he had the beating of his defender, you could see all the experience and the wise heads and the wisdom on his shoulders you know, knew exactly how to play that shot into the goal. And I say this, and it sounds like a harsh criticism, but I say this. He showed Morpay how to do it, because Morpay had another chance about 2 minutes later, not dissimilar, and Morpay could have done a lot better. You saw the wisdom of Welbeck's experience in sticking
okay, that well, ball okay, back well, there. And Andy, you're disagreeing there.
Well, first of all, I'm going to agree with our that goal was flipping brilliant.
Yes.
and it is the level of quality that Welbeck brings to this side, that you did have much more confidence in that he was going to finish that chance than maybe if he had fallen to Morpay. Because after that length of run, for him to compose himself and just take the keeper out, the keeper had no chance. Wherever the keeper went, the ball was going somewhere else. Welbeck was just waiting for him to sell it, and it was absolutely brilliant. Where I would disagree is, I thought the keeper did very well for Mopay's chance. I don't think Morpay could have done a great deal more.
I think he could have taken it round the keeper at the time. I thought it at the time, and I saw it in retrospect. I think he could have actually, he had it within him to take it round the keeper.
Well, I know, if buts, maybes.
I mean, the
instinct is to try and chip the goal, is to try and get it in, and the keeper came out very quick. Keeper was decisive, came out, made a risky challenge. He could easily have handed
outside
it
his area, yeah.
But let's get back to the
original subject here, which is Welbeck, and actually it was Welbeck who set up Morpay for that chance, and the ball for that. That was absolutely delicious, as was the ball from Adam Lallana for Welbeck's goal.
Already you're seeing little bits of link-up play that we just didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can overstate the impact that Lallana's had on the team, because he's absolutely sensational. But now Welbeck, slowly but surely, getting up to speed and looking every bit the quality elder statesman that we were hoping. He looks phenomenal, and you don't want to be harsh on Morpay, but he does look better than Morpay. But Morpay is a child compared to him. Still, he's only his second season at this level.
Yeah,
he's not greatly experienced, but now he's got a foil, and like him and Morpay do appear to be forming quite a nice link up, and it's really, really exciting. I mean, it was such an enjoyable game to watch, and throughout the team, there were positives everywhere for the Albion, and each of them made you want the next game to be the next day, because you just want to go and watch it again.
I would say this though. I mean, the forward players look very good, and of all the players, apart from the back four, I can't say that anyone had a poor game, and I'd happily give them the credit they deserve. But I think there's something that we've touched on before, is that one, Lewis Dunk really did look like he had sort of a bit too much dust around him. And he did start the game a little bit like Bambi on ice. I mean, the chance that Trezeguet had, where he ended up blazing that over the bar, Lewis Dunk would have normally stuck that in row Z, no messing about. In the end, he actually stuck it in front of Trezeguet to take the shot. There was a
slight... Well, I mean, actually, let's rewind then, if you want to talk about that one, because actually, if you want to go back to right to the very start of that move, it was actually a ball that Lewis Dunk tried to control on the halfway line, and he slipped.
Right, my point exactly.
And Watkins advanced to goal. We play 1-2 with Grealish. And Watkins slipped to the final moment, and then Trezeguet had not one but two chances.
But that's
to finish.
The point, AD. It was with Dean defending, and it's the sort of thing that we actually thought we got rid of. Don't get me wrong. In the second half, they all tidied their game up, because there were times when Webster was just being very, very sloppy on the ball. Not telling you anything about this, Marcus, but Webster was being sloppy on the ball. Ben White even wasn't sort of like 100% of the races. There was just a bit too much. Sloppiness from the back. It got better during the game, but we can't afford to sort of take that many chances. And let's face it, in that first half, as much as we say we controlled a lot that half, but also Villa were creating chances themselves. Don't get me wrong, it could have been 4-4 at half time.
I would say that it was the Trezeguet chance was really the only guilty chance they had.
It wasn't, Andy.
And he should have scored it. That should have been.
Matty Ryan had was brilliant in that first half. There was a lot of crucial saves that he had to make, particularly the really unorthodox one where he actually managed to somehow keep the ball out with his feet.
I was expecting the line thing to buzz there. So
yeah, but there was the one that was looked like it hit the post, but it was actually saved by Ryan. And Watkins was getting in time and time again. I mean, Villa going forwards were great. Going at the back, they were shocking. And as Al correctly said earlier, I mean, on another day we could have. Lallana had a chance in the first half. Welbeck had another chance in the first half.
But AD, all I'm saying is that the Villa were good going forward and shake at the back. Certainly in that first half, so were we.
Yeah. And there was also some more psychedelic refereeing when Matt Target got a yellow card that should have been red for the elbow on Morpay, which we've seen time and time again that our players get sent off for. And then the half-time whistle went. We lost Adam Lallana. And we also
Who had on his place actually? Remind me.
It was Veltman, I think.
Okay, so it was a complete change around. The point is that I'm making about that is as brilliant as Lallana is, I don't seem to recall that his absence, I won't say it didn't make any difference, but you're right, Andy, about when you're saying about how sensational he is and how he can pull the game, and you get to realise that actually whoever this, I know it was Ben White, then went into midfield. You're quite right.
That's right.
We didn't actually seem to lose too much impetus in midfield. I mean, it was a slightly different second half, a bit more attritional, but I thought that Lallana's absence. I mean, I'd rather have him playing than not, but it wasn't massively missed, and it's not a criticism of him. It's just I think that the way that we can be so fluid, it seems to work out okay.
Well, I think it's testament to the consistency of our play. I mean, we're getting inconsistent results.
Yes.
But the performances are not inconsistent. They are consistent. The players are now used to this style of play. And that's all the players. That's not just the players that are picked to begin with. It's the substitutes and it's the players that are held in reserve. And that is testament to Graham Potter, because like the penny's starting to drop all throughout the squad now as to what is required.
Mm.
I think
you need that increasing quality as well, though, don't you?
And
compared to last season, we've had that.
And I think the additions of the players like Lallana and Welbeck, they've helped make other players better. I think they led by example, and B, made people's positions in the team slightly more tenuous.
Well, yeah, along those lines, then let's look at this. Then, I mean, we've talked about him before, only in sort of like passing, because let's face it, during the pre-season, how many times have we said this is his last season? This is he's got to do this. Is the re-emergence of Solly March, and he's played left wing wing back before. I guess in probably at times and places and spaces that hasn't really worked for him. And yet he now seems, don't know if he is, but he seems quite comfortable and at home with it.
Where he's actually been spoken about in England terms.
I couldn't agree more. I think the penny has dropped with him. The manager's continued faith in him has finally given him the confidence, because getting the results now, he's had, got two goals. He's consistently involved in key moments of our play going forward. Now I think he now believes he can do it, and I think it's absolutely thrilling, because he's not a player that would have been first on my team sheet 6 weeks ago.
Mm.
But he is now, so obviously he's going to be dropped for Trossard against Liverpool. But it's just an utter joy to watch him really.
He looks like he's enjoying himself, doesn't he?
Yeah, and we will get to talk about him quite a bit as we move on through the match. But yeah, I mean, I just think it's all coming together, and like it's not an instant recipe for success. This this cake's got to be this. You know, I know this is in the slow cooker, not the microwave.
Yes, there is that.
That's such a great analogy. Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Should be in the microwave.
But I mean, the goal we conceded, it was another one from a set piece. I mean, there was question marks about whether it was a foul or not as well, which I'm still convinced.
If it was on Jack Grealish, of course it wasn't a foul.
It was
what it was, mate. It was pathetic. No one picked him up. It was zonal marking. Everyone just stopped. I mean, it was a brilliantly placed free kick, and it was actually would have been irrespective of proper defending or not. It was actually a very difficult one to defend because of, you know, the rare moment that Traore had to actually put it on the sixpence that he did. And it did invite something like that. However, dear God,
it is a massive worry for me, Andy, particularly with the team we're playing this weekend and with their ability to score those sort of goals. Something's got to happen with these free kicks. I mean, presumably they must be working on something in training. The zonal work marking system isn't really working, is it?
Well, no. In a word, and I'll just take my blue tinted spectacles off and place them on the table in front of me, and just say that goal was absolutely appalling and it, quite frankly, inexcusable. Yes, it was a great ball in, but you know it might as well have been a penalty. As soon as I saw where that free kick was, I had every confidence that Villa were going to score, and I had very little confidence that we were going to defend it well. And it's a shame because I think. In other aspects of our play, we're very good at defending. We're very good at cutting down real, genuine chances during open play in the game. But every time we give away a free kick in that position, just outside the box, it's lethal. You know, it's just it is absolutely infuriating, and it is the same. It's a repeat. Mm-hmm. When you look at the goals we conceded video up at the end of the season, you just need to look at the first one because the rest
of the first one and then rinse and repeat.
Because and as much as I've been lauding Potter thus far, that is something that he's got to sort out and
blind spot.
And the thing is that the defenders are so far away from the player that scored, you're not even sure which one of them was meant to be picking him up.
I'm worried.
Do you think there was a bit of confusion? Because basically, both yes. Grealish and I can't remember who took it. Was it Trezeguet? It wasn't Trezeguet.
It was Traore
who took it. Yeah, that's right. I mean, they were probably there expecting the ball to come in from Grealish. And I think they got sucked into it. But White and Webster just completely turned off. And they're like, no, after you. And it was just terrible. They need to communicate better. But let's not dwell on the negatives. Let's go on the positives. Yes. And that goal from Solly March. What a beautiful finish to a fabulous team move.
He shinned it.
Oh, it was absolutely. it was just brilliant. And
it was a bit sexy, wasn't it?
It's so nice when you quite often get in games. You get these great moves end to end. Great passing, and you say, oh, if only that had gone in, it would have been such a brilliant goal, and this time it did. And it was sort of off his right foot as well. But so much good interplay on the way to the 18-yard box, and then Groves basically taking out the entire Villa defence as they all sort of rushed back to the 6-yard box, and they were sort of looking at Morpay. And then March was just left there sneaking in late. Keeper had no chance. And I did love Morpay's rather boyish.
What did he do?
Celebrations as he just sort of stood there, like some little gnome, just like with his hands outstretched. just like it was so gleeful.
It was a thing of beauty. I never really spotted it until the match of the day analysis. And again, I think that they're probably Alan Shearer was absolutely spot on the money here. And it was the best pass of the move was Gross's assist. Because like you say, I mean, playing it across the area, and he didn't even play it particularly hard, and it was bobbling on the way. But because Mopay and Welbeck had taken out the rest of the defence by moving forward, and I guess that's probably where I've got to be a little bit more considerate of Mopay. His finishing is woeful, but his off-the-ball play is actually probably pretty good, is that the pair of them have taken out the Villa defence just by, you know, moving forward 2 yards, and the Villa defence has obliged it. I mean, don't get me wrong, Solly March could have still ended up sticking that into the it was towards the whole end, wasn't it? Was it the other end? I can't remember, but he could have still ended up sort of like, you know, skying
in the stands.
It could have done, but thankfully the net got in the way. And let's face it, for him, it was a swinger. He's a left-footed player, and it was a swinger. But yes, it was a thing of beauty, and it's about time we score goals like that. And that's the sort of thing that we have been screaming out for, been creating all that time, and each time the ball's gone flying off, or it's going to be an insipid little trundler, or it's gone to the corner flag. And it shows that what this game has done for me is showed that we can do it. And if we can do it, then we should do it.
Okay, well, let's move on. Psychedelic refereeing once more. Trezeguet elbow to Veltman's throat, which actually saw Grealish get booked for, like, a yanking Veltman off the floor. And
Grealish is in love with himself, isn't he?
I have to say, this is not a game which Grealish endeared himself.
This was the next point here. Is actually, I've got what the note I've got written down here, because I didn't actually realize this until I watched the highlights on the Seagulls player today, was the squeal of anguish from Grealish that got Lamptey sent off.
You know, he is a very good player. He does have something about him. There is something of the night about his game. He doesn't need to do this. Maybe it's something that, because he is head and shoulders above the rest of that Villa team. And I'm not going to go quite as far as say they're one-man team, but they are horribly short without it. But he doesn't need to do this. And it's a part of the game, you know, that aligned with his really irritating hairdo, as if any of us three can actually really talk about hairdos. But the aligned with all that kind of attitude, you know, he's actually almost like permeating his own anti-hero status amongst everyone except the Villa fans. You know, the Villa fans will say he's this, 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 and this. He always gets kicked up in the area. That's because he invites it. It's because he knows how to sell it to a referee. He doesn't sell his foul to the player. He sells it to the referee.
He actively seeks it. The way he just completely contorted his body in front of Lamptey. And I mean, how the referee thought that was, regardless of whether it's foul or not, how is that a yellow card?
Yeah.
I mean, can we all agree that the first one was yellow? I think we can agree.
Yeah, I'd have given a yellow card for the first one. I mean, Lamptey was just beaten to the ball and caught the guy late. So I don't have a problem with that. But the second one is questionable whether it was even a foul or not. And then
it's 5 minutes to go. They're pressing for an equaliser. And they'll do anything in their power to get what they want. And if that means losing the best player or the fastest player or the biggest threat, that's what they'll do. Fast forward into 90 minutes plus whatever it was, and Trezeguet's been shot.
But I just want to rewind a little bit there. I mean, basically, if you haven't seen it, go if you want to see the just listen to the squeal from Jack Grealish that got Lamptey sent off, and then look at the tackle. And then try and work it out. But I mean, interestingly, that's 3 reds we've had this season, and we've got 1-2 of them. Our two wins have come this season with a player sent off, and the other player we got a point out of at Palace, were a game which we should have won.
It's not particularly a good tactic I'd actually suggest that we employ, though.
Definitely not. But I mean, we also had less possession in this game as well than we normally do.
We scored more goals.
So when VAR strikes back, I've watched this again and again and again, and like it depends on what colours you're wearing, I guess. But I mean, it's never a penalty in a million years, is it? This one, I mean, Solly clearly wins the ball. There's no contact with the player, and the guy screams, goes down like he's shot. I mean, it's...
At first viewing, I didn't think it was a penalty. You could clearly see the ball moved away. That in itself is not necessarily reason enough to give a penalty, but the ball clearly moved on a different trajectory because Solly March had got it. The next thing is that, you know, you then got Solly March's follow through. In order to kick the ball, he's got to put his leg out at a certain sort of, you know, angle, and it catches very, very lightly Trezeguet's leg. Fine, okay, but there was nothing that Solly March did that made Trezeguet go up. He didn't fall to the ground. He didn't collapse. He went up. referee initially bought it. And of course, with these things with VAR, they're always looked at anyway because of the, you know, the nature of, you know, how important a penalty is. And, you know, justice was served. You know, we might say, yeah, VAR was served us well there, but dear God, it didn't serve us well at Palace. So we can't really sort of say all hail VAR. But, you know, I don't know, Andy, when you're watching it, did you see the ball move away? Did you think never a pen?
I just saw a guy do a complete swan dive. I just saw, I was so angry when Oliver gave it. I didn't think it was a foul. I thought it was an elaborate dive, which it proved to be. If you look at the replay, he's already throwing his arms up before he gets anywhere near Solly. And it's just pathetic. And again, I mean, ironically, after saying I'm done with VAR, it did
what it was meant to.
It did work for us. So, I mean, you know, swings and roundabouts and all that. But again, it's rooted in a poor decision, initial poor decision by the referee.
That's exactly what VAR's there for. I mean, basically, he went and looked at the screen. He saw he made a mistake and he corrected it.
I am just livid with the quality of officiating on and off the pitch this season. It's been absolutely awful. Mm. It's been a really poor standard. There's errors. I mean, we talked to, you know, I mean, we've had to gloss over, like, you know, the two elbowing incidents, our penalty, and because we've got to talk about this incident. It's just like, just watch the game and get it right, you idiots. Come on.
Okay, and on that note, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has sent us a shirt of the week, which I'll send over to Al and Andy here. Can you just have a look at this and tell me what you think of this, Andy Bass?
It's quite a nice little number. Basically, black and amber stripes with a slightly gradient tint on the black stripe, on the hoop
it's horizontal stripes.
Yeah, horizontal. Yeah, so the hoop's going down the shirt. Quite very nice colours. Sponsored Chestnut Homes, and I can't quite make out the...
I've zoomed in on it. It looks like the maker is something like Fowles Bonara.
Fowles Bonara. Never heard of them. I'm going to have a guess and say this is either a sort of sideways Cambridge United shirt, or maybe, if I'm going to go lower league, Boston United.
Andy Bass, you've nailed it. It is indeed Boston United.
Great. Well done.
There
Mike.
You go. I thought you were going to say Barnet, but yeah, there you go. But similar colours. Then here is your shirt of the week. This is the 2004 to 2006 home shirt of National League Northside, Boston United. Nicknamed the Pilgrims, they will play their first ever match at their brand new 5,000 capacity Boston Community Stadium on December the 5th. Formed in 1933, they plied their trade in the Midlands League, the Northern and Southern Premier Leagues, and United Counties League. They've had a colourful recent past. Under the guidance of controversial manager and part-time coach driver Steve Evans, they gained promotion to the Conference League in 2000 and then to the Football League for the first time in their history in 2002. After five seasons in the league, the writing was on the wall for the Pilgrims and they were virtually broke. Had players walking out on the team, and for the last game of the season, Evans had 12 fit first team players and populated the bench with U team players. They lost a game to Wrexham and were relegated in May 2007. To add to their woes, the club then went into administration and were relegated two divisions. Since then, they yo-yo between the fifth, sixth and seventh tiers. Brighton have played and beaten Boston three times in competitive games, all of them in cup ties, the most recent being in 2006 in the Johnson Paint Trophy. They won 2-0. Jake Robinson and Dean Hammond were the Albion goal scorers that night. For some Albion links, how about Harold Wilkinson, the former Albion winger, joined Boston after leaving the Seagulls in 71 and went on to be the Pilgrims player manager for the 75-76 season. Trevor Benjamin had spells with both Brighton and Boston. Steve Melton was another, and other players were Albert Jarrett and Michelle Kuipers. Not forgetting one more link. Graham Potter played 12 matches for Boston in 2004. And a quick quiz question. What famous name finished his career with Boston in 2004?
Paul Gascoigne.
Bang on. You know your Boston history.
Oh, yeah.
This is quite scary, actually, Andy. I mean, now and again, obviously, over the past year, I've been my better half. And a couple of times we've had to make literally a pilgrimage to Grimsby, and we have to go through Boston on the way through. So I've actually seen that stadium being built. It doesn't actually look... I'm surprised that you're saying that they're going to have their ground ready for the December the 5th, because last time I drove past it, which was about the back end of October, it really didn't look ready. That said, it is an out-of-town thing on an industrial estate or a retail estate. The one thing I would say about it is the floodlights. They do look kind of amazing. But apart from that, it's a nicer place to go. If we get the opportunity to go there, I'm sure we will at some point in the future.
There you go. Right then, it's competition time here on the Albion Roar. And firstly, thanks to everyone who entered our competition to win a copy of Tim Quelch's book, Good Old Sussex by the Sea. What was the question again, Al?
The question was that Tim asked us was, he mentioned a former Brighton player back in the days of black and white. When we used to wear grey and white stripes. He played for Brighton, he played for Millwall, and he had polio as a child. Which player was he talking about? The correct answer was the late, great John Shepherd. And I believe, Aidy, that we have a winner to this competition.
Yeah, we have. We did the draw earlier on today, and we are delighted to announce that the winner of this particular competition is Mr. Dan Maskell.
Dan, long gone are his days of commentating on the television, who I say. Well, congratulations, Dan. There'll be a copy of Good Old Sussex by the Sea.
We'll be in contact with you, Dan, and we'll get you a copy of that hopefully in time for Christmas. Okay, well, this week we have another competition for you. And
Christmas is coming, can't you?
Yeah, that's exactly what I've got written down here. It's almost as if Christmas is coming. People have some stuff to plug. Basically, once again, we've teamed up with a brilliant Art of Football who are offering a chance to win one of their Brighton T-shirts or prints, which you can see, along with all their other fantastic designs, over at www.art-of-football.com. And basically, if you have a look at their Brighton designs on there, there's a few of them, and both myself and Al have had the hand in designing a few of these, actually, which is great. And
Teddy Bear drinking Harvey's Ale, wasn't it?
And that's exactly the one, yeah. And also we helped put together the collage of the Brighton shirts as well.
I've got one of those shirts. It's lovely.
And a lot of their stuff is absolutely brilliant. So go on to artoffootball.com, and their stuff is great. But to win one of the Albion designs on there, all we need to know is the answer to this question. What was the name of the dog that famously found the stolen Georges Rimet World Cup trophy in 1966? So what was the name of the dog that famously found the stolen Georges Rimet trophy in 1966? Email your answers over to thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk, and we will reveal the winner on next week's show. Good luck, everyone.
Just say that if it's to be within a chance of winning. Yeah, so the quick question to that is what was the name of the dog that found the Georges Rimet trophy after it had been nicked? How typical of the English, they can't look after anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, it's time to start singing Back Home, because that's where 2,000 of us will be heading next Monday night for the visit of Southampton to the Amex. Basically, I mean, we found out today that we're recording this on Thursday, that Brighton, as is most of the country, going to be in Tier 2, Al.
No, we were hoping for 4,000, but one thing we do know is that having had the Chelsea friendly, we can quite easily and quite comfortably cope with 2,000 people there. We know it's not just about the people being in the stadium. That social distancing has already been sussed and sorted. It's about entry and egress from the stadium. And we were there at the game, and I say the train to and from Falmouth was empty. So we certainly know that 2,000 people will be available to go. From there on in, and this is where kind of things when the club did do a brilliant job during lockdown of telling us about how they intend to have ticket allocation once we start coming out of lockdown. Even then, things have changed, because at the time they were talking about with the view of having 8,000 or 10,000 people there, and this time it's 2,000 people. Although I'd imagine, and I think we will have this, I have to have this confirmed by the club in the next couple of days, is that it will be again a ballot to ascertain who are going to be the 2,000 people. Jenny Gower, bless her, is going to have her work cut out. I don't envy her job one bit at the moment. So this is going to be, all I hope is that, for the sake of everyone, is that the people will be patient. There will be some people who feel they have the self-entitlement, that they turned up to some good awful game in 1968 when there was them and another dog there, and that was it. So I hope that we as fans can actually be patient and virtuous enough to realise that this is not going to necessarily, well, hopefully it will, but not necessarily go as smoothly as it could or should do.
Now, Andy, it is good news. Also, I mean, we're going into like the Christmas, and we're not quite sure exactly what's going on. And there's going to be certain elements of match day routine which are obviously going to go completely out the window. For instance, I believe that you can only go to a pub if it's serving food, and you've got to have a meal with your drink. So I mean, I don't know what this means in regards to getting a beverage at the Amex or on things like that. There's all sorts of things to sort out, but the main thing is we get fans back in the stadium, Andy.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's only going to be 2,000, but it'll be 2,000 real fans. It means we can turn the fake noise off on the TV if we're sat at home watching it and listen to the real fans making the noise and atmosphere, giving the players some backing. As for whether we get tickets or not, I mean, the ballot, I'll get a ticket or I won't. It's a tough thing to organise. You can't account for everybody's individual circumstances. If you can't go, put it in the ticket exchange. I will certainly buy it off you if the opportunity arises. So it is nice that we've just broken the ice on this, because I think with the way that we've been treating different sets of circumstances in which people can or cannot congregate, I think we've been unfairly against people in stadiums, dependent on, you know, what league they're in, which just seems totally daft. I mean, I've been to watch some non-league football with small numbers of people, and there's no reason why, just because you're watching a team in the Premier League, that watching a game with small numbers of people is inherently more dangerous in that environment. I think it's good. I think it just shows that it's possible to do it. I thought the Chelsea game worked absolutely fantastically. Basically, if you are lucky enough to get a ticket, just be sensible, you know, keep the social distancing, obey the rules, obey the instructions, go in, don't mess around, just go there, enjoy the game, back the team, and then hopefully more and more people will be able to join you later on in the season.
I mean, that's a very pertinent point you're making there, Andy, because like you say, it's all of us, rightly or wrongly, and I think probably wrongly, but all of us will be judged on those who are going to be there. And if you're going to behave like a bit of a, you know, I don't believe in COVID, I'm not going to wear my mask, I'm not going to do this, that and the other, then it's going to have an effect on the rest of us. And if we're going to actually be, you know, together in this, you know, like it or lump it, you know, just now and again, you have to have a something sandwich that, you know, you're just going to have to sort of munch on now and again. So, yeah, be warned for the fact that actually, if you're going to be there at that first game, you're effectively almost an ambassador for the rest of your fans, because if you're not actually going to behave, it's going to have an effect on the rest of us.
Mm. I mean, one thing that you and me did pick up on at the Chelsea game, Andy, was the fact that the stewards were brilliant, and they were, there were people that did forget to put on their masks after having a bite of a pie or something, or having a drink and wandering around. And the stewards were actively reminding people to put their masks back on in a very helpful and not intimidating way.
You didn't feel condescended. You didn't feel sort of like
no, not at all. They did it in a jovial way. We said, "Don't forget your mask, there, mate." I mean, I was wearing mine, so it wasn't me. But I mean, we did see him, about. We're talking to other people, and it's just don't forget your mask. And then people were like, "Yeah, good." And then everyone was great with it. And as an experiment, the whole thing was a massive success. And it's just annoying that it's taken this long to get this far into get people back into league ads, because it does make a difference. It will make a difference to the performance, I'm sure.
It's only March and probably then get stage fright again. And that's what worries me.
There might be a few of those, but it's a great thing, and we're absolutely delighted, and we can't wait to have fans back at the Amex.
I think
a shame it's a Monday night now, and yeah, it'll be kickoff time.
Probably going to rain.
Southampton.
But despite all of that,
what do the Romans ever do for us?
Still want to go.
No, I think people just have to be mindful of the fact that it's not the 10,000 or the 8,000 the club were talking about when they had their big open session back in whatever it was, August, September. To say that, this is what we intend to do. It is 2,000, and even if you take the 23,000 season ticket holders, and everyone wants to go, that's still only 93% are not going to be able to go. Sometimes you just have to suck it up. If it gets to it, you think, I'm not having this. I can't get this. Sorry, it's not great. It's not ideal. It's rubbish. But it's all the same for everyone else. So just kind of deal with it.
Okay, Andy. We also got some. Bad news this week in the fact that we lost one of the football's greatest ever players.
Yeah, absolutely. A controversial figure, maybe a flawed human, but I think we can all agree an absolutely magnificent footballer, Diego Armando Maradona. Simply one of the best people that we will ever get to watch play the game, and a huge loss to the game of football. And I, for one, really enjoyed watching him play. I mean, he was just mesmeric. And I think what marked him out from like players like Messi and maybe Ronaldo or Pelé is that like Maradona won things on his own. I mean, that 1986 World Cup was not a great Argentina side, and he willed it all himself. I thought it's absolutely incredible. What he did in Naples is one of the great footballing stories of all time, in my opinion.
He did exactly the same thing with them, didn't he? He pretty much single-handedly won them the Scudetto.
It was just phenomenal. And there was a documentary that came out, I think, in 2019, which was recently, I don't know if it's on Channel 4, if it's on Netflix or Prime or something, but if you haven't seen it, I thoroughly recommend watching it. It's an incredible story of primarily what he did in Naples. And sadly, it features other elements of his life that weren't so great, but just brilliant, brilliant footballer. And he was just simply better than everybody else. Out on his own. I can't think of any peer player of his when he was at Prague that came in close.
You have to remember this was a child genius who was marked out from the age of about 16 as to how good he was going to be. I think there was contemplating him being at the 1978 World Cup. I think they just sort of saw him being a bit too young. He was only about 18 at the time. And Argentina had its own squad ready. I mean, led by Mario Kempes, you had Houseman, you had Bertone, you had Ardiles in the middle, you had Vera on the bench, and it was a great side in its own right. So fast forward to the 82. We first saw him in England in 1980. There was a friendly that England-Argentina played. I think England won it quite comfortably, but again, you could see him just absolutely mesmerising everyone. We did wonder what we were going to get out of him in the 82 World Cup. What we got was the fiery side of him. He was kicked all over the place, but dear God, did he know how to retaliate. And his World Cup ended in disgrace by kicking out a Brazilian player, trying to take his head off with his studs and red card sun. Even in Spain, that's a naughty thing to do. There is that iconic picture taken in Spain of when Argentina played Belgium. It was a group match. And it's one of those that actually sort of grates me a little bit because it says, oh, it shows how great Maradona was. But actually, what it is, it's showing the Belgian wall just breaking from a rubbish free kick. And it was a game where he was rubbish. And I was
in the 86 semi final.
No, that was the 82 World Cup. That particular one was the 82 World Cup. I know this because Belgium wore white shorts in the 82 game and they wore red shorts in the 86 game. So and also no games took place in Mexico in the evening because of European television. So no, it was certainly the 82 World Cup, but come the 86, as you say, he won it single-handedly. I don't think, I'm talking, you know, Pelé for Brazil in 1970 was something else, but that bloke single-handedly won the World Cup for Argentina in 86. He was untouchable when he's still got Gary Lineker, 35 years after the event, still going on about how mesmeric it was and how in awe he was of him and how no one could touch him. Don't get me wrong, that second goal that he scored for Argentina, admittedly, he's against Peter Reid and Steve Hodge, but the fact is he still had to do business.
Terry Fenwick.
That pitch, basically, I mean, anyone who's played at Southwick will know what a bad pitch is. The pitch at the Azteca that day was as good, or if not worse, than that pitch at Southwick, because it was like wobbly, and for him to have that skill and that mesmeric skill that took, obviously we had decent defenders still. I mean, you mentioned Terry Finnick, but I mean, you know, this is an England side at the World Cup finals. This is no bad team.
It wasn't rubbish, but he made them look rubbish.
Should have been a free kick before he got the ball, to be honest, but it was a clear foul. But it was, you know.
Wow, is that the sound of the barrel being scraped? I can hear there, AD.
Well, look, I mean, look, Maradona's gone on, he's done that several times to several teams. It's just, that was just one of the iconic ones. And one, I mean, you know, if you talk about Diego in many other countries, everyone's got their own different version of that goal, which they can talk about. I mean, he was just a mesmeric player.
So many other countries don't have the same issue with Maradona that we do. I mean, that's the point, is that one, it was Argentina, a country we had been at war with 4 years earlier. Two, you know, he did it to us. You know, the ignobility, the outrageousness, the lack of hate, this, it's not cricket, that he did it to us. Yeah, it was a moment in time, but let's face it, if he's going to be judged by that one incident, then the judgment is all off. He must be judged by what we saw on the pitch, was probably one of the greatest ever players ever to don a football shirt, and we should be grateful that we saw him in our lifetimes.
Okay, we've just got a tiny little bit of time just to talk about the Liverpool game this weekend. Jürgen Klopp says, give us the points. Thanks very much, Jürgen, don't mind if we do. But in regards to this particular question, they're playing us, they've played Champions League game on Wednesday night, and they've got to play us on Saturday at lunchtime. You know, I mean, it's not quite right. Bearing in mind, normally, in normal times, basically, if you're playing on the Champions League on the Tuesday, you play on the Saturday. If you're playing on the Wednesday, you play on the Sunday. So this game, not only is it on the Saturday, but it's a lunchtime kickoff, and they've got to travel to Brighton as well. So,
well,
boo-hoo. Saturday, I mean, Wednesday, Saturday is always all right. It's Thursday, Sunday that's the one. So if it was Saturday, you'd have a point. But where was their game on Wednesday?
Against Atalanta, and they lost 2-0.
At Anfield.
And they rested half their team.
Well, in that case, as I say, boo-hoo.
They were saving their players for us.
We've got them running scared, lads. We've got them running scared. But that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much to Alan Wares and Andy Bass. Don't forget to enter our competition. That question again, Al.
I can't remember. The Oxford one.
Yeah. So two. Okay.
Found the World Cup.
Oh, sorry. Yes. What was the name of the dog who found the World Cup after it had been stolen from the Stanley Gibbons stamp exhibition in London? Only the English could do this, and only a dog could find it. So, what was the name of the dog?
Thanks for listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB and a podcast. Yeah.